We have, and we also ask that you turn off your cell phones so that you don't interrupt us during our lecture. We're going to have a 1 hour lecture and then about a 10 minute break and then another hour of question and answer afterwards. So we hope that you stay for the whole thing. We have beverages in the back. Feel free to avail yourself of those at any time. My name is Mike Moneski. I'm the secretary of the Marxist School of Sacramento. And welcome to all of you. We have some new faces here. Thank you for coming. Tonight we're pleased to say that we have Dr. Cynthia Kaufman, a philosopher from De Anza College in Cupertino, California. She's been here once before to talk about her a prior book that she had written, Ideas for Action, Relevant Theory for Radical Change from South End Press. She's here to talk tonight about her current book, Getting Past Capitalism. She has books for sale over on the other side. She'd like to have you put your name and email address or contact information so that she can get in touch with you. She was educated at the University of California, Berkeley, got a developmental studies degree there in 1984. Then she went to West Germany, went to Tübingen, Albert Ludwig's University, and studied philosophy. And then went to the University of Massachusetts, Amherst, and got her philosophy PhD. Her thesis was Desiring Reason. Reason is an unavoidable discourse of desire. And I'm wondering if that's the karma of reason or some kind of maybe proletarian karma, the kind of dependency trap that you talk about. Maybe you can tell us if there's any connection there. She teaches on the philosophy of science. She teaches and is chair of the Department of Women's Studies at De Anza. She does also interdisciplinary teaching in philosophy, art, and anthropology. She also has taught at Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. She is a philosopher. And here we're to talk about one of the big philosophic giants that we discuss is the works of Karl Marx, and she does pepper her work with the work of Marx and other Marxist historical materialists. In her book, Getting Past Capitalism, we had a discussion on Tuesday, and I prepared a three-page outline, which I'm not going to go through tonight because I'd like to give our lecturer an opportunity to speak. But she talks about, in her introduction, culture as a tapestry, that capitalism is as a fungus that infects the tapestry. And sometimes the tapestry, if you have a rug and you take it outside and you beat it a few times and you get the dirt out of it, sometimes you'll find that there's an infecting organism in it. And to the point where you might have to have some of it rewoven, and that's the way I understand the metaphor that she uses in her introduction. In her first chapter, she talks about capitalism as a problem, and the problems of capitalism, including the invisibility of capitalism, women's shadow work, colonialism, slavery, and so on, and also the language of capitalism as workers and consumers, how we use the language of capitalism and how we own it, we take it on. And also the violence of capitalism. She talks about markets as well and the alienation of consumerism. In her second chapter, she talks about different ways of thinking and focuses on Lenin and George Hegel and their teleology and how the nation is an appendage, the nation as an appendage to capitalism, that the dependencies and the ways that we think of capitalism and nations working together, but we need to get beyond that point and think in terms of revolution and reform as a subtle synthesis. In chapter 3, she talks about capitalist reproduction, and she cites two authors that she cited before in other books, Omi and Wynant, on their social formation theory, which is a deeply hybrid set of practices that are interrelated but not easily untangled. And it fits into the tapestry metaphor that she uses in the introduction. She also talks about social projects and the four ways that capitalism is perpetuated through the desire of the people, through the actions of the owning class, through the function of the state, and how it becomes a necessary twin, the protection of private property, police, banks, and jails, creation of markets, special interests, policy planning, candidate selection, ideology, all those things that our local, state, federal, and global governments do that hold a control and perpetuate capitalism. And finally, capitalism's trap, the economic dependency. And she cites Przeworski and why sociologist, who asks why European socialists haven't dumped capitalism, and that's probably because re-election of politicians is dependent upon improved lifestyles, not on the state. In chapter four, she talks about the complexities of capitalism, and that it should we should try to understand it not in that teleology of Lenin and Hegel, but where there is this necessary twin between the state and capitalism, but rather that there's this Taoistic approach that that where there are and that we should take that that challenges to power require assessment of points of balance. So where is it off kilter, and those are the places where we can push back. The alternatives to capitalism, she talks about the four markets of commodities, capital, currency, and labor, and then she also talks about Rousseau's household-based neighborhood economy and community as opposed to capital, and also the community development corporations, the Mondragon Network in Basque Spain, and the worker cooperatives that are here in the United States, that there are 20 million members in nearly 50,000 worker cooperatives, including credit unions, electric companies, and farm products. And then finally, she talks about how to put this into practice. And she talks about disrupting the memes of capitalism, the systems of domination, such as sexism, racism, disability, homophobia, then the disruption of capitalist practices that has happened, like microlending in India and disinvestment in South Africa, the discussions about climate change and the AB 32 that's here in California, and finally the housing bubble crash, kind of the undoing of capitalism in 2008. And then finally organizational building, that the non-governmental organizations that we have, the nonprofits, are really a long march through the institutions. And market-driven, pseudo-corporate environments are really what these non-governmental agencies are. There's it pits organizers against bureaucrats, social change against service deliverables, and visions against outcomes. And then finally, she talks about agitation strategies and nine action guidelines. And compares the rigidity and the opportunistic nature of Lenin's vanguards and the current global justice movement that follows the logic of the swarm. So if that isn't enough for us to talk about tonight, I don't know what. That summarizes pretty much three pages of my scatterbrained notes on the book, and I'm pleased to introduce Dr. Kaufman and have her explain herself. Thank you.
All right, maybe I don't need to talk anymore. So what I wanted to do was to, let's see, this light's going to drive me crazy, but I also sort of need to be able to see. No, it's good. Yeah. So he kind of gave a general overview of the book. What I wanted to do was just to read you a couple bits and pieces here and there and then get into a conversation about it. So I am going to read a bunch from the introduction. And he gave a pretty good summary of kind of what's going on in all the different chapters, so I think I won't just say that. Okay, I tend to talk too fast, so tell me to slow down, okay? I really want you to say slow down. I first started thinking about politics just after the election of Ronald Reagan. It was 1981, and I got involved in the movement to oppose U.S. support of a dictatorial government in El Salvador. Am I loud enough? Okay. I began reading and talking to people about the world's problems. I began to wonder why there was so much poverty and strife in the world, why the U.S. would support a dictator, and what kinds of things needed to happen to deal with these problems. I quickly came to believe that capitalism was a significant aspect of these problems that I saw in the world. But almost as quickly, I came to see that talking about capitalism was one of the best ways to get my ideas dismissed as extreme, as in favor of authoritarian communism, or as unrealistic. I believe that capitalism rewards greed and fosters a society in which it is hard for people to pay good, productive attention to the needs of others and to the ways that we are all interconnected. But I also realize that many people see it as the only viable form of society in the modern world. Wondering about capitalism has pushed me to think a lot about what other kinds of economic and political systems might be possible. And as he mentioned, I have a whole chapter on alternatives, and I'd love to talk about that, because I think there's a way, when people talk about alternatives to capitalism, it's sort of, they think of capitalism as an all-or-nothing thing, and they think of the alternatives as an all-or-nothing. You know, do you want this social whole or this social whole? In my chapter on alternatives, which I'm not going to get into, but we can talk about, one of the things that I argue is that there are many things that we're already doing that are not capitalist, and that we should grow those things, and that we have forms of socialism, and we have forms of communism, and we have forms of gift-based in sort of indigenous societies with us right now, and it's important to grow those, as opposed to saying, imagine a utopia where everything's completely different. Okay. Although I'm opposed to capitalism, I'm not opposed to all uses of market mechanisms, trade, or entrepreneurship. Each of those things can play a positive role in an economy under the right circumstances. But investment for profit becomes a problem when profit-making consumes such a significant amount of society's resources that investors gain the power to transform cultural and political systems. When capitalists control a political system, other ways of living and using resources are drowned out. Capitalism is a problem because it allows those with resources to use them without regard for the needs of others. That disregard leads to the destruction of communities, to millions of people around the world not having access to the basic things that they need to live healthy lives, and to environmental degradation. Capitalism is one of the most important forces responsible for the fact that people don't have time to do what they love. Along with racism and sexism, capitalism is a powerful force for generating and maintaining devastating forms of inequality. It is largely to blame for the slow response to the global catastrophe being caused by climate change. And I'm a climate activist, and I would love to talk to you about climate if you want to go there. And by the way, chapter one is a whole kind of, a lot of people that I've given the book to are sort of using that one chapter, sort of, it's just your basic, you know, 20 pages, what's wrong with capitalism, relies really heavily on Marx, and for this crowd, I'm not even going to touch it, because you guys know what, you know what I'm going to say there. I think Marx's critique of capitalism is almost entirely right, and just, like, there you have it, okay. On the politics side, not so much. The what to do about it side. How do we undo capitalism, a system that has been developing and growing for more than 500 years? By this point, capitalism has become a central part of the fabric of most of the societies that we inhabit. How can we dismantle the capitalist home we live in when our activities every day effectively shore it up? No matter how anti-capitalist you are, if you live in a society dominated by capitalism, you probably need to work for a wage. Most of us spend many of our waking hours doing paid work and much of our leisure time shopping or otherwise consuming commercial culture. Capitalism even structures our most intimate relationships. People often express love by buying things for people. We might judge people by the products that they use. When capitalism comes to dominate society, when all other ways of meeting our needs come to be devalued and pushed out, when governments operate to serve the interests of privately owned capital rather than the needs of people, we have a serious problem, and that problem is capitalism. Okay, I'm gonna skip a whole bunch. Okay, I started thinking about these issues when I went to a talk given by the geographer Julie Graham. The main point of her talk was that anti-capitalists should follow feminists in seeing their task as pushing back on practices that they're opposed to rather than as overthrowing the system. And this, I think, is the core claim of the book. Feminists have approached the problem of challenging male domination by seeing that the problem is happening in many different places in society, and it has no core or command center that needs to be taken out. This approach led to strategies of fighting male domination by fighting it in each of its manifestations and by looking at how separate manifestations are linked to each other. So again, it's like there's this way that I think in traditional Marxism you see it as a totality and you expect it to be an all or nothing machine that you're either for or you're against and you have to get rid of all at once or not at all. And what feminists have done is to say, I don't like that, I don't like that, I don't like that. Let me analyze, let me figure out what these things are about, let me understand there's structure, but let me take them each on as they need to be taken on. Okay. Much of Graham's work, along with her writing partner Kathy Gibson, and they wrote under the pseudonym J.K. Gibson Graham, has been to show the variety of ways in which we currently meet our needs that are not based on capitalism. We take care of our needs by making things at home and by sharing with friends. Governments take care of many of our needs with schools, public transportation, and in some countries, healthcare. People work at and produce things in worker-owned cooperatives. J.K. Gibson Graham claims that more than half of the labor performed in the United States takes place outside the sphere of profit-making. So one of the things that I really want to argue in this book, and Mike kind of said it with the tapestry metaphor, I'm going to get into that more, but I want to say it real strongly right here, is that rather than thinking of us as living in a capitalist society, I want us to think of ourselves as living in a society where we have all kinds of communal relationships, all kinds of mutual support relationships, all kinds of socialist relationships, the things that go through the state, all kinds of communist relationships. There's lots and lots of things going on in society, and capitalism is just one part of that. And we want to think about what is that one part of our society that's capitalist. It's a big part, I'll admit that. But we'll think about that part of our society that is capitalist, and let's figure out how to get rid of that, as opposed to saying all of society has to be sort of, you know, gotten rid of or overturned. Okay. Before learning about their work, I believed capitalism to be a serious problem, but I also thought that the times were not right for challenging it. After all, capitalism was booming in the roaring stock market of the 1990s, and the idea of socialism had been thoroughly discredited by the brutality, corruption, and final collapse of Soviet communism. The only people who talked about opposing capitalism, such as various Marxist-Leninist groups, talked about trying to foster a revolution to overthrow it. And they, in their analyses, seemed to me wildly unrealistic. It was I'll talk about that more later too. It was exciting to me to see that there are realistic alternatives to capitalism, that we thrive in those alternatives right now, and that society can be transformed to the extent that these alternatives can become stronger and more predominant in our lives. Graham's and Gibson's approach allowed me to imagine a world without capitalism, and the opening of that space in my imagination gave me the courage to look at organizing against capitalism as a realistic possibility. We can begin to think of fighting capitalism as we think of fighting a fungus or a virus that has damaged the body politic. It has become entangled in our cells and needs to be fought from within and from without with complementary treatments. With capitalism, the enemy exists throughout the social fabric, and challenging it will for some involve a struggle to redefine our sense of meaning and purpose in life, as well as a struggle for the ruling class. In other words, it's in our souls, it's in how we think of ourselves. As we struggle to get rid of capitalism, we need to work in ways that are more like the Chinese philosophy of Taoism, where we push from inside to transform a complex network that we ourselves are a part of, and that constitutes our very being, and rather than a war where an opponent is defeated. If we can see capitalism as a set of interrelated practices, we can also see its connections for what they are and not overstate the extent to which they're fused together. We need to develop ways of conceptualizing capitalism that render it solid enough for patterns to be revealed and yet open enough to see places where it's vulnerable. Metaphors and images are central to the ways we understand and use concepts. And if our common metaphors and images fail to adequately reflect reality, our thoughts can be structured in ways that don't serve us well. Capitalism is reinforced by the image of a market functioning beautifully by means of an imaginary hand effortlessly allocating resources where they need to go. It's helped by a powerful confusion in people's minds between freedom and democracy in the world of politics and the freedoms of markets and corporations. And in chapter one, I have a whole big thing about the idea of sort of, you know, capitalism equals democracy equals freedom, and that really what they're talking about is the freedom of people with capital to do what they want with that capital, and those are two entirely different concepts, and it's such a basic, simple thing to say, and yet there's so much social confusion around that. I think when you're talking to people about capitalism, I think taking on that idea of freedom and democracy is really, really important. Okay, instead of an image of a world composed of rational, competitive individuals, each fighting to get as many resources for him or herself as possible, we need to develop an image of society as a tapestry of people and all of nature interlinked in a common fate. Imagine our different languages and cultures as a variety of patterns that reveal common as well as unique solutions to the problem of being human. Think of capitalism as a fungus that has dulled the colors of a tapestry and weakened its fibers. Only by diligently cleaning every strand of the warp and woof, every embroidery stitch that is implicated in capitalist practices, can we create a human tapestry with greater beauty and brilliance. Those of us schooled in the dominant anti-capitalist imaginary, in other words, like typical anti-capitalist Marxist ways of looking at things, in which capitalism is an organic whole, a system that should be overthrown, might consider replacing that concept with an image of capitalism as a set of interrelated practices that need to be pulled out from the tapestry that is our social world. Think of pulling capitalist elements from the social fabric and replacing them with other forms. I'm going to skip a little bit. Overthrowing a system brings to mind an image of a solid and distinct thing standing on its own that can be knocked down. But this way of looking at capitalism is not very helpful. Rather, we should see capitalism as a set of practices implicated in and structured in an immense variety of life's aspects. Destroying it will be more a matter of transforming its networks than overturning a structure. The image of overthrow encourages a politics that looks for fulcrums and tipping points. Such an approach oversimplifies what we're doing and makes it hard to identify the tasks in which we need to engage to challenge capitalism. So then, just the end of the introduction, I make this claim that I think that sometimes in social movements, people are very creative and they come up with new thought, with new ways of understanding the world. And then those ways of thinking kind of become fossilized and you're just sort of stuck with them without really thinking about it. And I guess I think that the anti-capitalist imaginary, in other words, how people who see themselves as anti-capitalists, how they understand what they're up to, really comes from the late 19th, early 20th century, and it really gets defined in these debates among German social democrats in the 1920s. And there's a way that when people say, you're a reformist, well, you're a revolutionary, people sort of use those words in these ways without really thinking about what they mean by them. I feel like they're just kind of, they're relying on what I consider very fossilized ways of understanding a debate that came from another time. And so actually, because this is the Marxist Society, I want to challenge you guys, I want to take that on. And so I normally, when I read from this book, I do not get into chapter 2, but I want to do that here, and it's going to be fun. Okay, so just a couple of sections from chapter 2. Okay, so this is called Ways Not to Think About Getting Past Capitalism. For many years, I've listened carefully to how people who see capitalism as a problem talk about their political work. Usually, it's spoken of as a limit. They suggest that we can do so much to change a situation, but once the problem we're dealing with goes up against capitalism, we should probably give up. Capitalism, after all, is simply our condition. There's nothing short of world revolution that will make that condition change. I want to pause here, too, and just say that I get into this a little bit later, but I want to say just real clearly and directly is that when I think about, I'm going to mention Rosa Luxemburg in a little bit, and she was one of the real important people in that whole debate in the early part of the 20th century, Polish, German, Jewish philosopher. And Luxemburg had a belief that a lot of Marxists have, that there's these sort of inherent contradictions in society that sort of work themselves over through time. It's what Marx got from Hegel. I like Hegel a lot as a philosopher, but I think this part of Hegel is completely wrong and completely devastating for politics. So that's kind of the claim I want to make and just throw out real strongly, is that the Hegelian idea of contradictions, sort of, you know, that history is sort of a working out of certain contradictions, and there's a kind of a natural path that it takes. Once you get sort of from Marx's period to Luxemburg's period, you have what Luxemburg thought, and like I said, there's a lot that I really love about her thought. I actually named my daughter after her. She was a really excellent critique of the lack of democracy in a lot of Marxist movements, a beautiful thinker. But here's where I think she was completely wrong, is that Rosa Luxemburg accepted that teleological view and thought that capitalism was about to reach its little point where it was going to have a crisis and it was going to all blow apart and then the whole thing was going to collapse and then we would have socialism and then eventually we'd move towards communism and we'd all be happily ever after. So the thing is that didn't happen that way, right? Now some people say it didn't happen that way because Marx was wrong and capitalism just develops. I don't think that's true. The reason I think it didn't happen that way is that the working class got organized. And if you think about Western Europe, the working class formed unions. Those unions were incredibly powerful. They fought really, really hard, and they got concessions from capitalism. And capitalism became a really different animal. It became an animal that gives a lot of us, especially in the first world, the possibility of a middle class life and a life of pleasure and consumption and all that. That was, I want to say, that was a direct gain of working class struggles. We won in those struggles. Now, what a lot of, if you take the sort of Hegelian approach to all this, what you're going to say is, oh, but that just made it so that the working class was confused and just accepted capitalism. And I just think it's disastrous politically. Because again, early in the 20th century, there were all these revolutions to overthrow capitalism, and some of them worked. Usually they were revolutions to overthrow dictatorial governments. And it's not that hard to overthrow a dictatorship. Well, I mean, obviously it's extremely hard to overthrow a dictatorship, but what I mean is we see lots of examples historically where that's succeeded. But you can't completely transform the social fabric by just having an overthrow. Okay, back to reading. So opponents to capitalism are long in critiques and very short on the positive steps for doing anything practical about it. It's like you gotta wait till the time comes right and the contradictions get to the right place, and then, bam, it's all gonna happen. You gotta be there and ready for when it happens, but there's not much we can do now when we're not in a revolutionary moment. Okay, many people doing important political work might characterize their work as only reformist, seeing no alternative to capitalism. They soldier on doing what they know needs to be done. Imagine what excitement and inspiration they might gain if they could see their efforts as part of a long-term project of getting rid of capitalism. How we think about the nature of capitalism has huge implications for how we think about anti-capitalism. If we accept the picture of capitalism as a robust, adaptable system that can create every sort of social effect it needs to keep itself functioning, then it's likely that we will see schools, for example, as nothing more than factories for the production of workers, governments as no more than agents of the ruling class, and household labor as something created by capitalism for the reproduction of the workforce. Within this view, this agent called capitalism makes things happen to keep itself functioning and co-ops or destroys all efforts to challenge it. Capitalism comes to be seen as a terminator, destroying all in its path and all powerful in its ability to fight off challengers, changing form and shape when needed, and always intent on its goal of destroying human resistance. Even more powerful than the Terminator, capitalism is seen as having such a high level of cunning that only its internally created crisis points will make it vulnerable enough to be destroyed. There are good reasons why people opposing capitalism are inclined to think of it as a totalistic system. It's a helpful antidote to a kind of thinking endemic in a capitalist society where connections between social processes are obscured. In other words, most people, especially in this society, don't see that there's a social fabric that they're embedded in. They think of things in individualistic terms. And Marxism is a good antidote to that. Karl Marx's critique of capitalism remains unparalleled in its insight into the ways that capitalism operates and the problems it causes. And yet, many within the Marxist tradition have relied on ways of analyzing the problem that make it difficult to imagine realistic approaches to anti-capitalist politics. How can we separate those totalizing threats from our tapestry and envisioning more promising ways to challenge capitalism? Now, I'm going to skip ahead to just a little bit of this Rosa Luxemburg stuff. Okay. Current critiques of reformism often rely for the rhetorical force on reactions that many on the left have had to the evolutionary socialism of theorist Edward Bernstein, a Social Democratic Party member of the German parliament. This is back again in the early part of the 20th century. His view is often taken to be the paradigm of an anti-capitalist reformist. Arguing against the left wing of his party, Bernstein claimed that the party should give up on its demand for revolution against capitalism and instead would work to reform capitalism to make it serve human needs. He believed that capitalism would evolve naturally into socialism without any struggle. I'm going to skip a little bit. And of course, that was wrong. Okay. And Rosa Luxemburg correctly argued that that was wrong. In a long text criticizing Bernstein, and in many ways setting the stage for some of the problems that later Marxist critiques of reformism, Luxemburg stated her belief that that capitalism would be abolished through an inevitable cataclysmic break. Luxemburg argued that Bernstein's view of a gradual evolution away from capitalism was wrong because the, quote, scientific understanding of history that was laid out by Marx required there to be a great dramatic break with capitalism. So here's a quote from Rosa Luxemburg. From the standpoint of scientific socialism, the historical necessity of the socialist revolution manifests itself above all in the growing anarchy of capitalism which drives the system to an impasse. But if one admits with Bernstein that capitalist development does not move in the direction of its own ruin, then socialism ceases to be objectively necessary. So the point is that in Luxembourg, there's all this sort of stuff about, you know, the sort of objective nature of the struggle that's coming, that I just think it's just wrong, okay? Her faith in the objective necessity of that break, rather than her analysis of whether or not it was so, was grounded in an almost religious acceptance of Hegel's doctrine of teleology, the inevitable stages through which societies progress. Bernstein had correctly argued that capitalism was more flexible than Luxembourg and other revolutionary Marxists had believed. Yet he was wrong in believing that those with power would give up their power without a serious struggle. So I want to say that the Marxists are right in their idea that, you know, there has to be a struggle that has to do with power and that you've got to challenge power, but really wrong in that in the way that, that Marxists have traditionally seen the whole sort of objectivity and teleology stuff. So I'm going to skip way to the very end. This is the very last couple pages of the book. We're at a propitious time for challenging capitalism. Energy, and even though I have Occupy in the title, I was done with the book by the time Occupy happened, and it made me so excited. I was just like, yeah, I've got to get my book out, because that's what's happening right now. And I think Occupy is really in alignment with what I'm saying in this book, and that's why I put an Occupy picture on the cover. We're at a propitious time for challenging capitalism. Energy for changing our society in profound and lasting ways is growing. There's an infinite number of things that can be done to move us along in the process of getting past capitalism. Below are 10 priorities to help focus that energy. So number one is delegitimize capitalism. For many years, those opposed to capitalism have been afraid to name it. If, like anti-racist and feminist movements, we're able to get to the point where it is common knowledge that capitalism is a destructive social form, and where many people understand the ways it works, more people will be able to decode capitalist manipulations. More people will be able to not vote for them, more people will be able to organize against them, and more people will be able to contest the ideological space in which pro-capitalist memes propagate. We need to talk about capitalism as the destructive force that it is. When engaging in protest actions, make connections for people, write pamphlets, make creative poster signs, name capitalism where appropriate. And I have to say that I found for myself, I call it internalized McCarthyism. I'm going for my, you know, I teach at a community college, I run a community organizer training program and an office that does service learning and stuff like that, right? I got invited to talk at a conference in Arizona, and they asked me for a bio, and I almost left the title of this book off of my bio. And it was just like, you know, that I myself have spent all these years on this, am kind of afraid to come out as an anti-capitalist. And it just strikes me that so many people on the left who I know are afraid to talk about capitalism when it's really the most obvious thing to be talking about. So part of it is about, like, could we please break through our own internalized McCarthyism? Okay. Number two, challenge, jam, and replace pro-capitalist memes and generate and propagate anti-capitalist memes and dreams. So a meme is this idea of sort of like a scrap of cultural stuff that self-propagates. So if you think of, you know, the freedom of the market as one of those memes, it's just this kind of idea that it just infects your brain and it connects things and people just sort of think it without even thinking about what they're thinking about. And what I'm saying is that we need to challenge those pro-capitalist memes or sort of like little ideological scraps, and we need to come up with our alternative ones. And I think that We Are the 99% was just humongous. I mean, that just cut through. It just felt like it was like detergent going through grease. It was just like, can we just stop with that? And it was very powerful. And in the book, I wrote this before that had happened, and I referenced the story of stuff, which you should see if you haven't seen. There's this wonderful 10-15 minute video that's it's up on YouTube. It's a little animation that just explains the kind of the absurdity of consumerism just really quickly, really cleanly. It's just you're in, you're out, you've got the idea. Okay, number three, live in ways that help you to not be a capitalist desiring subject. Find ways of generating pleasure and meaning in your life that don't rely on consumerism. Downshift your expectations to the extent that pleasure comes from making and doing rather than from buying. Attend to the quality of your relations with others and the natural world. I want to dig into that for a second too, because as I was writing this book, I ran across this whole literature that I found really exciting about the concept of happiness. I don't know how many of you have been following that, but there's a whole bunch of social scientists, a lot of them very mainstream, who've done this empirical work of just asking people, are they happy or not? And not happy in the grand sense, but just happy, like, are you content with life? Is your life a good life? And what they found with, you ask it in any different language, you ask the question lots of different ways, pretty much they get these universal results that, surprise, surprise, just won't surprise anybody in this room, what makes people happy is a sense of security, a sense of connection with other people, a sense of belonging, and that a very stratified societies lead to really deep levels of unhappiness. And yet, if you're in a stratified society, you are happier the higher you are, right? And so what they found is that in these sort of international studies that they've done of this, the United States comes out roughly the same as Costa Rica. And when you think about the difference in material wealth and kind of throughput in Costa Rica, and one of the happiest countries in the world is Bhutan. Bhutan is a little tiny place up in the Himalaya where people live on about $200 a year. But it's a place that has really strong social roots, where people, strong senses of community, very low levels of stratification, very low levels of consumerism. People have a sense that they're going to be taken care of when they're old. They have a sense that they have that their children will be cared for. And one of the sort of most powerful things you can do in a society to increase the general level of happiness is to lower the level of stratification. So it's really, really interesting stuff. And there's a way, of course, that we all get sort of wrapped up into the kind of status stuff. So one of the things that I argue in the book is that, you know, it's not just the big bad ruling class that's trying to kind of, you know, brainwash us and, you know, extracting profit from us. That's all true. That's happening. I think it's important. I'll get to that in a second. But also the way we comport ourselves as being a part of that kind of culturally. So I think the cultural work to be done to reclaim a different kind of life is really important. That's a life about, you know, repairing your shoes rather than buying new ones, you know, not being all into having the latest, the best, and all that kind of stuff. That's sort of the sense of kind of decolonizing your mind from that sort of that capitalist consumerism, I think, is a really important part of all this. And spreading to other people the idea that, no, I actually am perfectly happy. I live in a very small house. Of course, when I bought my house, it cost a fortune, but still, I live in a very small house, and a lot of my friends and neighbors are remodeling these little houses and making them giant, and I keep saying, like, no, you know, there's three of us, we have one bathroom, we're all good, we can share, it's no big deal. And actually, it's less to clean, and so there actually is a whole sort of, you know, design kind of, it is a bit consumeristic, but movement of, you know, sort of small is beautiful, and the kind of small house is a cool house. I really love the fact that my house is small. You know, it means I can yell at my kid from wherever I am. It means I only have one bathroom to clean. You know, stuff like that. It's like the bigger is not necessarily better. Bigger has more status, but it's not necessarily better in all kinds of ways. Okay, number four. Propagate anti-capitalist ways of understanding and measuring the economy. So this is another one that I think is really important. And that, you know, the way we, and I spent a lot of time in the book on each of these things that I'm summarizing now, but, you know, the way we measure our economy in this society mostly is by GDP, right? So the GDP goes up, we think we're doing well. And the thing is, though, probably most of you know this, the GDP measures the amount of the economy that goes through the capitalist market. So if you have people working 60 hours as opposed to 20 hours, and if everybody's working a ton of hours, everybody's paying for childcare, everybody's paying for their meals, everybody's paying for to go, and like, I'm so busy that I need to just like blast off to Mexico, get a 2-week vacation, and come back because I don't have time to just kind of hang around and enjoy life, right? You end up being productive, and that's good for the economy. Whereas the GDP goes down if we all say, you know what, I'd rather actually just do less, consume less, make more, share more, trade more, just kind of have a more relaxed lifestyle. That's bad for the GDP. There's an economist from New Zealand named Marilyn Waring who wrote this great book called If Women Counted. And what she argues is that, you know, things like the Exxon Valdez or the Deep Horizon, this was after she wrote her book, but, you know, they're actually extremely good for the economy, right? Because you have to pay all those people to clean up all the mess that was made. And so the point is that the sort of what the capitalist economists will call good for the economy is actually often really terrible for human beings, and actually especially terrible for the environment. So I just think, as a climate activist, there's no way we can keep a really high consumption, high throughput economy and this concept of infinite growth and survive as a species. It's just not really possible. So something's really got to change. And so one of the ways, you know, so we don't want to just talk about that as evil. We also want to come up with alternative ways of measuring it. Because, you know, so there are a lot of economists who've done really great work in recent years, and this is all becoming quite popular. And by the way, there's a whole field of this, they call themselves new economy theorists. And there's a bunch of them, I think because of their internalized McCarthyism, none of them talk about capitalism, but they basically say a lot of what I'm saying here. And they're developing real, you know, sort of economists' tools to do this work. So there are actually two indexes that I like to talk to people about. One of them is called the Genuine Progress Indicator. And what it does is it measures things like infant mortality rates, literacy rates, levels of contentment, environmental, no, this one doesn't have environmental perspective, but those sorts of things. You know, how much leisure time do people have? How long do they live? And you can actually, they quantify those things, and you put it into a measure, and you say, like, and so that what I would love is to see, you know, I live in the Bay Area, and I listen to KPFA all the time, which is a great radio station, but I would so much love it if KPFA said, hey, guess what? The economy is doing better. Our genuine progress indicator has gone up. They never do that. And yet people are starting to do this, and even the conservative government of England, so David Cameron has started, the British government has now started tracking the genuine progress indicator in England, and in France they're using a similar kind of an index. So it is spreading, and in Bhutan, the whole economy, all of their econometrics are based on the GPI. There's another index that takes that and also puts environmental things into the same framework called the Happy Planet Index. And it's a really cool index, and it sounds kind of, you know, like it's a cute name for it, but it really gets, what I like about it is that economists will often say, yeah, that's a bunch of very nice, lovely stuff, but you know, but what's really going on? We have to use our science and our analysis and our math to get at it. It's a way of beating them at their own game. And I also think it is really powerful. It's like you do a policy change and you say, did that make things better or did it make it worse? Well, if you have an index that actually measures what makes things better, you're going to actually see that. So I really think it's important for people to promote those alternative economic indicators. Okay, number five, this is the biggest one, that we need to challenge the major processes of capitalist reproduction in respectful coalition with others. Elaborate systems of social power, including mass media, the electoral justice systems, state-sanctioned violence, and systemic discrimination, all reinforce capitalism in different ways. Many people who are not committed to eradicating capitalism are doing important work to challenge these systems and are thus weakening capitalism's hold on people's imaginations and their physical survival. Anti-capitalists can work in these arenas to support such work. They can also, where appropriate, deepen this work by sharing their anti-capitalist analysis. Working to end the prison industrial complex, to support sustainable agriculture, to end inhumane immigration laws. In coalition work, don't talk about capitalism when it will not help the movement achieve its goals, but do talk about it when an anti-capitalist analysis will help people understand the deep forces at play in relation to their projects. So in some ways, almost most of what people think of as anti-capitalist work kind of fits under that. So I think of, you know, any work that people are doing to challenge Citizens United and the sort of, you know, the influence of money on elections, I consider that anti-capitalist work. And when people have wins there, I'm going to call those wins against capitalism. We're pushing it back, we're constraining its ability to control our lives, we're freeing ourselves for it. We have less capitalism rather than more when we win those struggles. Okay, the number six says, develop larger strategies that will build synergy between small-scale and dispersed activities. So when I think about those kinds of things, I think, I mean, it gives you two examples. I think the fight against the World Trade Organization was huge that way. It brought together environmental people, labor people, indigenous rights folks, into large coalitions to challenge a really overarching structure that made it so that as long as the WTO was able to do what it was able to do, it had implications for all kinds of things. So sometimes there are places that are sort of like nodes where you're going to get a lot of bang for your buck if you really work in that particular area. Another area that I put in that category is work time reduction. You know, what I was saying about the happiness stuff, I think it's really important to fight for a reduction in the working week. And I think that in this country, we're not going to get to work time reduction until we have national health care, universal health care. Because one of the things that ties people to full-time employment is that you need full-time employment to get decent medical benefits. So if everybody had, of course, this is the socialist plot, right? So this is how we're going to, and I know that everybody's like, you know, calls Obama a socialist. It's like, yeah, actually, I think he, you know, anyway, it's a complicated story. But the point is, I wanted to say, like, yeah, those things are socialist, and they're really good things. Now, not when you're talking on the radio and you're talking to, you know, everybody in the world are you going to say we want national health care because it's socialism. But I think it is socialism, and I think it's a really important thing. And I think that when you get national health care, you then get it, make it more easy for people to then also advocate for circumstances that make it that we can have shorter work times. So the reason why shorter work time is kind of one of those important nodes, which I just lost my page, is because it makes it so that we're less dependent on capitalism for our kind of cultural needs. It makes it so that we're less consumeristic. It makes it so that we can actually rebuild the fabric of our communities, and I think that's really important. As we're all so busy and stressed out, we have less time to put into kind of building community. And so I think it's really important. Also, if you think about so many of, I have a section in the book where I talk about the ways that anti-capitalism intersects with different oppression struggles. And I think work time reduction is huge for feminism, because it's like, you know, as long as what was traditionally women's work, there's no time for it, then what happens is that wealthy women, or wealth people in wealthy families, though the women are usually responsible for it, pay then poorer women to do that work that was traditional women's work, and then those women rely on other women in poor countries to then take care of their children, and it's this whole cascading thing. There's a really great book called Global Woman, where Barbara Ehrenreich talks about the global short crisis of care, how as we move to a more capitalist work, there's less and less kind of time and resource for caregiving labor. And so I think work time reduction is just super important for that. Okay, I'm almost done. If I can find my page. Okay. Number 7, make visible all of the ways that non-capitalism works well in our lives. We can foster the courage to criticize capitalism by promoting an understanding of all of the non-capitalist economic forms that are functioning well already in our lives. We can draw attention to the systems of sharing and mutual support that we all rely on, to the ways that state-run economic activity often works well, to the ways that cooperatives function well. Learn about non-capitalist economic forms and talk about them. And I think, you know, one of the examples that I often point to is the Mondragon cooperatives in Basque Spain, because it's more than $1 billion worth of activity goes through that network of cooperatives a year. So it's not just a small hippie collective that's kind of a fun and interesting thing to do in building community at small scale. It can work at a really macro scale, and it is working at a really macro scale. And there's a Gar Alperowitz is a guy who's written a lot of books, really interesting stuff, and I rely on him heavily in my section on alternatives. Talks a lot about how big the co-op sector is in this country. There's actually, you know, there are thousands and thousands of people working in cooperatives in this country, and many of them functioning really well. Okay, 8, support the development of community-controlled forms of capital. And what I mean by, do you guys have public power here in Sacramento? I think you do. So to me, that's a really good, I don't know how many of you like someone or not, but I have PG&E and I hate them. Alright, so that's an example where you pool community resources to have something that might in other cases be done by the capitalist market, done by the state, and you're using your local capital to make that happen. There are lots of examples of, there are all kinds of really good examples of that. You think about it, rather than trying to get giving a company tax breaks to bring stores in, why not actually use community capital to create community stores? And of course, when the banks all crashed, that's what all of us wanted Obama to do, right? Which he didn't do, is rather than bailing out the banks, start a national bank, right? All that money that was used to bail out those banks, if the government had just started its own bank and then loaned that money for the things that were needed to get the economy back going, we would have a completely different game right now. Yeah, that's right. And Roosevelt did it because there was a socialist revolution on the horizon that was about to happen. And I think so much of what happened in the New Deal was really a reaction to the rise of working class power in the early part of the 20th century. And so much of of course, a lot of it was racist and terrible too, but so much of what was good in what Roosevelt did, which is a lot, was really, those were huge gains for the working class. Yeah. Okay, 9. Build movements in ways that develop people's capacities. And what I talk about in this section is that there's a way that I think that we Marxists, and I consider myself a Marxist, don't help build people's sense of hope, that we often, you know, kind of lead to the sense of despair. And so that what I'm wanting to say is that if you think about capitalism in the way that I'm trying to do, that we declare victories a lot rather than sort of declaring, oh, that's co-optation a lot, we're going to have a bigger sense of hope to be able to work on what we're working on. So we want to feed our sense of hope, we want to give people a sense of belonging, we want to welcome people in movements, all that. Then 10 is just to think strategically. Let me just read this. Fighting against an enemy that is dispersed throughout the whole fabric of society, that is implicated in our own desires, i.e. like consumerism, that has no central core holding it together and making it function, requires subtle forms of analysis. We need to give up on the binary of reform versus revolution and look to build revolutionary reforms. That is, actions that step by step begin to liberate us from capitalism. We need to avoid oversimplifying and looking for simple solutions. fulcrum points or black and white understandings of what's going on. In all of your work, think about what you're doing and how it will add up to meaningful change. If we want to get past capitalism, we need to be clever, flexible, perceptive, and brave. Okay, just a couple more paragraphs of conclusion. We need to give up on false hopes of a major rupture where capitalism implodes on itself all at once. We need to stop focusing on states as the major locus of anti-capitalist activity. We are up against a shape-shifting seducer as well as a tyrant and abuser. Capitalism is supported by the use of violence, by the creation of forms of dependency, and by our own desires. Capitalism is more of a mutating virus or a chameleon than a building that could ever be toppled. We don't need to wait for the revolution to begin to get past capitalism. Getting past capitalism happens as we build economic forms based on community forms of capital, gift-based economies, worker-owned cooperatives, and government actions that serve our needs. We get past capitalism when we work in coalition with others to constrain the ways that capitalism is reproduced at all levels of society. From cultural memes that promote consumerism to economic structures of dependency to transnational legal apparatuses. We build a movement to get past capitalism as we spread realistic analyses of how capitalism functions, what's wrong with it, and how we can push it back. Rather than undermining practical political activity by pointing out that it's not revolutionary, anti-capitalist analysis can help inspire the work of people already are doing in so many fronts. We can show how other forms of struggle can be part of that movement for a truly better world, one without alienation, without exploitation, and one based on sustainable economics. As we build that movement, at every step along the way, life can be made better for those who are now unable to gain a minimal means for healthy existence, as well as for those who are more privileged. Life can be more secure, more interesting, more environmentally sustainable, and more equitable. It can be less alienating, less exploitative, and less dominated by the race for profits at all costs. And perhaps one day it will be completely free from capitalism.
I think we're going to take a short break, but first, okay. We want to hear from our fearless leader.